This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Matthew Aaron Goodman. He's the author of a novel called Hold Love Strong, which is a terrific book. I actually, I read a lot of books. I only interview people whose books I like a lot, but this one stands out for me. I think this is one of the best books I've read in a really long time. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, there's some controversy attached to this book, and I, as always, I'm going to assume that people who are hearing this have not read the book, so we want to talk about it, but without giving away the story. It's about a young black kid growing up in a project in Flushing, Queens, New York, called Ever Park, which is a great made-up name, I think. His mother is 13 years old.
Yeah.
And you start at the very beginning when he's born, pretty much. And then you take him through his, I would call, early youth to the time when he goes away to college.
Yeah.
What period is this set in?
Sure. The book is set in, he's born in 1982, so the book is set in the 80s, in the 90s, and he goes to, you know, leave for college when he's 18 in 2000, the turn of the century. So it's a time period in his community where the AIDS and crack epidemic very much wiped through the community and his youth, his childhood as he's growing up.
Right, and the crack epidemic is big time in, this, in the book. You know, again, without giving too much away, but it affects his mother. It affects other people that he sees around him. He grows up in a you know, in a tightly knit family where the grandmother is really the bedrock of the family. And, you know, obviously, you have some personal experience in the black community, even though you're not a black person. And I'm just sort of curious, how has that been received? How has it been received that this book, which is, you know, indisputably a great work of imaginative fiction, in my mind, you know, how have people reacted to it?
I think the people who have read the book have been, you know, really receptive, incredibly receptive to me and my efforts in telling the story. You know, the only negative stuff I've received is, I think, from people who haven't read the book and have responded immediately to the fact that I wrote the story.
Well, they make a judgment that that there's a certain kind of, and I can understand that.
Sure.
You know, that impulse is to protect your community from outsiders who are trying to frame it in a way that's not real.
Sure. There's a long history, I think, in literature and in American art in general, where there's issues with the black community in relationship to appropriation.
Colonialism.
Colonialism. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, that response has a lot of history and
validity.
Well, yeah, validity.
No, I think you have
can't argue with it.
Right. You have to give people credit for, even though you may feel that they're wrong, and I feel like, you know, it does allow us to, when we talk about this, to talk about the idea of authorship. You know, where does, if the assumption is you can only write about your own people of your own color or from the inside, then that's a limitation. That's a limit on the imagination that I think a lot of writers would object to. You know, it's like saying if you're a male, you can't write about women. Or if you're a woman, you can't write about men from the inside out. And I think a lot of writers would say that's not true. You know, that, and of course, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but, you know, obviously you have to agree with that because you wrote this book.
Yeah, I agree with it. You know, I agree with it wholeheartedly. I think the job of a writer is to imagine how someone else feels who's not themselves, to empathize with them, and to think critically about how the environment is playing in on their lives, and to use the privilege of their, be it their education or the privilege of the fact that they are pursuing writing and taking the time to think on things on that level, to explore these feelings. And I think a lot of times, when I think about our society, where we are at now, at, you know, the end of the first decade in the 21st century, I have to wonder a lot if sort of the predicaments of our society are related to the fact that we are still having this argument over whose right it is to tell a story, rather than to think about the story and what the story is saying about us as a larger group of people, as a society.
Right, which I would frame as, if you read this book, read it without, if it's possible to do. You know, it's almost like you have to blindfold yourself,
sure.
you know, to say, I don't know who the author is. I don't have to know who the author is. And it's sort of like a blind taste test in wine.
Yeah.
You know, if you could do it, take this novel, take away the name of the author, and let people read it without reference to who the author is.
Sure.
That would be a pure experience of the art. And I think it would enable people to have a more freeing conversation about it in a certain way.
Yeah.
But so you spent a lot of time in the community.
Mm-hmm.
You were teaching, is that?
I was living and teaching. When I started writing the book in 2001, and I had moved back to New York in 2000, the summer of 2000. I had been in North Carolina. I was washing cars. And a young woman who I grew up with was living in Brooklyn, and she, I had a crush on this young woman since I was 12 years old. And she said, you know, you're not doing anything in North Carolina besides writing and washing cars. You can do at least one of those things here in New York.
So which did you do, wash cars or?
No, when I came to New York and continued to write, and I got a job as a grill cook, and then eventually I got a job teaching in an alternative school.
In the city.
In South Jamaica, Queens.
You're in Queens.
And I was living, when I came to New York, you know, I didn't have a lot of money, so I stayed with her for a short while, bounced around a little bit in the first place I was able to live in. I rented a room in a boarding house in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and this is 2000-2001. So I was, you know, this is sort of before Bedford-Stuyvesant is sort of beginning to go through a renaissance. So I was living and working in the community, and, at the end of the day, when I would leave the kids at school, I would, you know, have to confront a lot of the issues in the community, you know, that they were going home to confront as well. Mine very different because, I believe that where I was staying was a temporary place until I got on my feet. For them, it was, you know, their life every day, you know.
And what grades were you teaching?
I taught young men and women who had never gotten out of eighth grade.
So it was like a high school equivalent.
Yeah, it was a pilot program, and the school, you know, it was just a tragic situation. The school year began, and we didn't have enough books or papers. There was no phone in the office. It was just the stereotypical story you hear of an impoverished urban school lacking all resources and support.
How many kids were you
teaching? We started with about 200 kids, and we started that year, and we didn't have enough desks or chairs for the kids. I think we had maybe one-fourth of, you know, than that. We had enough desks and chairs for a classroom of students to sit down and the others to figure out where they're going to go. And that's how we began the year. And as the year went on, we, you know, got chairs and we got some books and we got things, but it was a work in progress the whole time. And
is that school still in existence?
No. What they would do is they opened it. That year was the first year. It was a pilot program. And they opened the school, and then they closed it at the end of the year, and then they reopened it the following October. And basically, it was a school for kids who the mainstream middle school principals didn't want those kids back in the school.
So these are kids are how old? They were like 15, 14?
Between 14 and 18,
right.
Yeah. The majority of them were from two housing projects in Queens, the Baisley Bay housing projects and the 40 housing projects. And many of them were, you know, gang involved and came from families that were, torn apart by all of the situations and institutions that infect poor urban communities, you know, between the prison industry and people's struggles with lack of jobs.
This sort of drug culture being the only form of employment, which then forces people to become criminals in order to make a living.
So
I guess a couple of questions. In your growing up, where did you grow up?
Sure. So I grew up in a small town called Somers, New York, on the border. It's in the northern edge of Westchester. It's on the border of Connecticut.
I know where it is.
Growing up there, I had a very rural life. My father and my mother made a decision. They were either going to move from New York, from Queens, to this tiny town, or they were going to move to Israel. And my parents, the whole decision was to move to a place where they can get their kids the best education. So we lived in this little town and had a little yard, and we planted fruit trees and had a very, very different existence than the young men and women in the book.
Although you have roots in Queens, it sounds like.
Yeah, roots in Queens and in Brooklyn and in the Bronx. You know, my father is of that generation, the Brooklyn Jewish people who, you know, will live and die in Brooklyn, Brooklyn Dodgers, you know.
Right.
I knew I probably could have named at one point, by the time I was 7 or 8, everyone in the 1955 World Championship Brooklyn Dodgers. You know.
I just finished reading a novel called Perfect by mm-hmm. Lou Paper, who I interviewed. And it's about the World Series 1956, mm-hmm. Don Larsen. You know, yeah. All those Brooklyn guys
sure,
were
yeah.
in that. It's a pretty good book.
Yeah. Well, there's a great, I think, is it Dom DeLillo, who has it's a book, Kafka at the Wall,
yeah.
which is, I think, a section of a larger novel. I want to say it's of White Noise, but I could be wrong, but it's a great, great, I think it's a novella, and it's incredible.
So did you ever think of yourself when you were, you know, setting out, assume at some point you set out to be a writer, because I know you got an MFA mm-hmm. from Emerson College, so you obviously wanted to be a writer at a certain point,
mm-hmm.
but did you ever imagine yourself living in Queens, teaching teaching the kids that you taught and writing this novel, or did this happen somehow as a result of your experience?
Yeah, it happened as a result of my experience. I basically, my daily schedule was I'd wake up at 5:30 in the morning and get on the G train and take the train out to Queens and get on the bus and then teach. A gentleman who was the math teacher would drive me to the train station. And as we drove, we would talk about the day, and I would tell him in the car, his name was Jay Cho. I would say to Mr. Cho, you know, I'd say that I wanted to do something about what was going on. Because, you know, every day was, every day was a war, and not with the children to fight with them to learn, but to deal with the reality of their situation.
Right.
And so I would say to him, you know, I'm going to do something. And, you know, I really, the only thing I've in some way known how to do or felt comfortable doing, expressing myself, was with writing. I said one time to someone else, if I played the trumpet or the trombone or something, a saxophone, you know, no one would have heard a word from me, because I would have just, you know, played music to deal or to express what I was thinking and feeling. But, you know, I never learned to play the trumpet, so.
Well, but this is, you know, to me, what great art is. Literature is art, is the transformation of experience through mm-hmm. writing. And, you know, if you do it well, then it affects other people,
mm-hmm.
which I think you've done. And I guess, you know, you can't help but wonder how you managed to inhabit, you inhabited a kid who's so different from yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It means that you're, you know, you did empathize with the people around you. Were there any, I mean, did you model this on a particular kid, or is this kind of an amalgam of a bunch of, not just, the main character's name is Abraham Singleton. He's got some, you know, other mm-hmm. siblings that are, you know, they're really well drawn. I mean, it's a whole family. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just focus on Abraham, although he obviously is your alter ego in the mm-hmm. telling of the story. He has a cousin, Nice,
yeah.
name,
yeah.
The basketball player, and two stepbrothers,
yeah.
or half brothers,
cousins, yeah.
Who he lives with and mm-hmm. who really raise him,
yeah.
And of course, you deal with manhood and, you know, what it is. You talk a lot about the internal battle that mm-hmm. he goes through to try to figure out who he is.
Mm-hmm.
The love, so much of the power to me was that kind of the back and forth, the love and hate. The love that he has for his mother, the hate that he has for her, the love that he has for Donnell,
mm-hmm.
who, essentially raised him, and then he hates him at the same time. That mm-hmm. was really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But I go back to my original question, yeah. I mean, to pontificate.
That's okay.
Are these drawn on specific people, or kind of, do they kind of, you have to imagine a whole bunch of different people to come up with them?
One thing I did, you know, while I was writing is I did everything I possibly could not to write about anyone I knew. I felt that, that would be, you know, I was not working where I was working because I wanted to write about the situation. You know, I was working in that school because I fell in love with this young woman, and I felt that after I was working as a grill cook for about 6 months in New York, I didn't know if that this was the job which was going to seal my chance with her, winning her heart here in, you know, New York City.
So did you?
Eventually, yeah. It took a long time. And eventually, you know, we did. We got married. And,
yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. But it took, it wasn't, I wish it was one of those easy things that you slide into a relationship and everything is beautiful. But, you know, I came to New York with pretty much nothing and didn't know what I wanted to do besides write. And I think that, you know, it's in some way it runs the risk of being stereotypical, but it's not necessarily the easiest thing to be in a relationship, both when you're trying to write or create art in the city and for the other person be in the relationship.
No, it's very difficult for the spouse of an artist.
Yeah.
Very different. And now, well, so what are you doing now?
Well, I was running a literacy program for youth coming out of prison or had involved in the criminal justice system. And then the organization I worked for lost their grant. So I lost my job. And so now I'm just working hard to, you know, on the second novel and some other stuff I'm trying to write. I'm just trying to use my time to write as much as I can and find a job, you know.
Did you write Hold Love Strong while you were working?
Sometimes I was working. Yeah, I was my sort of style of when I was working, I'd wake up still at 5 a.m. and I'd write before usually the sun came up and before I had to go to work. And I say like the last 3 years of while I was writing the book, I was working in a transitional facility for men and women coming home from prison. And so I would write. I was working there as a case manager, and then I had a couple other different jobs and a GED teacher. And I would write in the morning, and I think I would write in the morning because it would give me a chance, I think, to sort of process some of the stuff I was dealing with from the day before with work, and also because I felt I knew that in writing the story, people would take issue with the fact that I wrote the story, and I took issue with it myself while I was writing. I think I struggled with those questions, and eventually I would write in the morning, or decided to, is because that was a time of day where those questions and all the doubts seemed to be the quietest. And somehow I was able to convince myself that while the rest of New York and Brooklyn were sleeping, you know, I could do whatever I want. Is that when they woke up, you know, I had to in some way deal with what I was doing. And if I could be secretive about it, then it was easier for me.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, no, it makes sense, I think. And so do you feel like these characters are now still with you? Are they part of you? I mean, do they still inhabit a part of your imagination?
Yeah, they inhabit, I think, a big part of my entire body, I think, in some way, because it was such a challenging thing to write, because I had to not only imagine what this young black man was thinking about as he was growing up, I had to imagine the details of his life, and then I had to think about the social and political things affecting his life. You know, have the courage, I think, to write about those, and then deal with a lot of rejection. You know, the book was originally purchased by another publisher, and that eventually didn't work out. And there were times where, you know, people in the publishing industry, one person who I can remember, told me that, that I didn't write the book, that someone else had written the book, and that he, you know, was basically just going to wait it out to find out that I hadn't wrote the book, which was a difficult thing for me to take, because I think I wrote the book with, you know, everything I possibly had in terms of, you know, how I felt and thought, and with as much sensitivity as I could muster.
Well, which you evidently did. That's a fairly strange accusation.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that must be really hard to take. You know, if someone says you didn't write something that you know you did write.
Right.
But it is, I can understand on another level, mm-hmm. because it is so other from who you are.
Sure.
On the other hand, you know, I think it's a testament to your ability as a writer. You know, the internal, there's so much of the internal vocalization of Abraham, yeah. and how he thought about himself that I felt was just incredibly strong.
Yeah, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking that it's, I don't know if it's so much of a testament to my ability to empathize or to imagine as much as it's a testament to the people in the communities that I worked in and the people who I worked alongside, the men and women coming home from prison and the children to I think, embrace me in those spaces. You know, in a transitional house, maybe there was another person in the facility who had a college degree, and I was certainly the only 6'3" Jewish guy walking around. and we're talking about men and women who spent a lot of time in prison. And there's, you know, there's, I think, rightfully so, there's a level of potential level of mistrust with you when you have, you know, a white person in this space. You know, you associate them with parole, with the COs, with all the sort of the,
with privilege. Too.
Yeah, with privilege. And you know, I you know, worked hard at what I did, and the people there, I think, loved me. And you know, I had conversations that I think with men that only are had between intimate brothers. And so I think if the book is a valid depiction of this young man's life, and if it's written well, then I think it's more indicative of how the people responded and treated me as a human being. And I think that that's probably what shines through the book, is how I was loved.
You know? Well, I think that's very, actually really perceptive on your part to realize that. And I think it, you know, for people who are reading it, I think that comes across. You know, first you think, how did this guy do this? Mm-hmm. But you're reading the book. You get lost in the the words. You don't necessarily. I certainly, as a reader of the novel, was feeling the community, feeling the people, feeling those families coming through you, mm-hmm. which is, I think, what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I think you deserve a lot of credit for being able to allow that to happen. It's a really great book. So, you know, I want to thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you.
And say that for anybody who's listening, this is a novel called Hold Love Strong. Matthew Aaron Goodman's the author. I really recommend it to anybody to read. I think it's a terrific book. I'm David Wilk, the host of Writer's Cast, and thank you again.